Today, we're all looking for ways to save. That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance and monitors your medical claims as they come in, then flags any hidden errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's healthlock.com.
Hi, this is Kurtwood Smith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
Like our recent episode with sisters Regina and Raina King about the why behind their production company, Royal Ties.
We have such a huge love for storytelling without walls, without barriers.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds.
And Donald Trump's rally crowd went silent when he confused Obama and President Biden yet again. We have such an interesting show today. Former Rolling Stone editor Noah Shachtman joins us to talk about prescription drug use in the Trump White House. Then we'll talk to the host of the 5 to 4 podcast, Michael Leeroff and Peter Shamsuri, about the Supreme Court's latest descent into MAGA. But first, we have the host of the Enemies List, the Lincoln Project's own Rick Wilson. Welcome back to Fast Politics, my friend and yours, Rick Wilson.
Molly Jongfast, as always, I am delighted to join you on the stage of history.
Exactly, on the stage of history, which will absorb us like everyone else. This is such an interesting week because I feel like this was a week that the Biden administration did a lot of politically useful things that are like election focused. And that's not a criticism. It's actually a compliment because of the enormous stakes of this election. But you and I talked on the phone a little bit earlier, and the thing we wanted to start by talking about was the hottest crack addict we know, Hunter Biden.
Look, I have to tell you, the fact that he finally sat down for their behind closed doors deposition
wiped the floor
and
with that.
Knocked, as we say in the South, their dicks in the dirt.
I've never heard that.
He absolutely shamed and humiliated the moron crew of Comer, Jordan, Gates, etc., etc. He just absolutely kicked their asses up one side and down the other. And his opening statement had a combination of very well-written, clear denunciation of their tactics, and also absolutely dismantled the four witnesses that they have in this thing as criminals, frauds, people who are in jail for fraud, or Russian intelligence assets. Mm-hmm. It was masterful. And there's a reason they wanted to do this behind closed doors, because they were afraid something like this could happen.
I thought they wanted to do it behind closed doors because they hoped that they could then spin it.
They did. But the fact that the deal was a release of the transcript, that was absolutely a masterstroke in this thing that prevented them from, you know, just going on Sean Hannity and saying, "Well, we found another 700 witnesses at Burisma who said that wheelbarrows of cash were taken to Delaware." And look, this impeachment is dead. It is dead. It has no political viability. I spoke to a source last night who has some visibility into the thinking of the leadership, what's left of it. They want this over. They want this over.
Is that Cobra's service dog? I mean, who is that?
No, it is somebody with visibility into what's going on.
Into the dusty attic that is James Comer's brain.
Into the flaming pit of wild stupidity that is James Comer, yes. But at the leadership level, there are even people who you would think are very MAGA who are now like, this has to stop. This is crazy.
The only person, I think, who was like a little excited about it was MAGA Matt Gaetz.
I'd be real careful like talking about other people's addictions. Just saying.
And you're not the only person who said that. Hunter Biden said that to him.
He did indeed.
I'm trying to find where he said to Matt Gaetz that if I wouldn't be arguing about substance abuse if I were you.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty incredible. But also there was Eric Swalwell saying, did you get $2 billion from the Saudi government?
I know. Listen, you know, I got to say, I think the two people that have legitimately the most sort of like, you know, there's this old phrase called Berserker Gang, which meant like the fury of the Vikings, right? The two guys with the Berserker Gang with a real excitement here that love to go, oh, fuck me? No, in fact, fuck y'all to the MAGAs are Moskowitz and Swalwell, and they've become masters at inverting the bullshit gotcha game that has been the Fox News producer's greatest ally for the last 10 years. They don't want to do this anymore on the Republican side in public because they know now there are people who are going to clown them with better and more photogenic moments.
Producer Jesse has come along and saved us. Mr. Gaetz, were you on drugs when you were on the Burisma board? The witness, otherwise known as Hunter Biden. Mr. Gaetz, look me in the eye. You really think that's appropriate to ask me? Mr. Gaetz, absolutely. The witness. Of all the people sitting around this table, do you think that's appropriate to ask me? Matt Gaetz, unbelievable.
Yeah. Listen, Matt, or as they call him now in Florida, Governor Gaetz, he's running for governor in Florida. He keeps denying it, but then he comes to Tallahassee and sits down and has meetings with all of the political operatives in the state that are ready to go for his run for governor. This is a guy who has never spent a day of his life worried about consequences because daddy would always spend the money, write the check, get him out of trouble. A lot of the crap that they've laid on Hunter Biden, and look, Molly, you can speak to this, but a lot of the stuff about Hunter, he was, you know, taking responsibility for his addiction is something these fuckers would never do in a million years. And a lot of them have their own suite of addictions, including the cocaine and including, yes. I mean, I would say sex addiction is probably more prevalent on Capitol Hill than on a per capita basis than any place I've ever been.
Yeah. This is the thing. They have a very just completely fucked up view of how this is going to go. I also think what's interesting to me, and we talked about this before, and I want to talk about the Biden border trip now, is that what they're doing in the White House is, and I know because I was also there this week and we were talking about it.
Yeah, drop that A badge, yeah. Love, baby.
Fuck you. I didn't get any of the cookies. They have these cookies with a seal and I forgot to get the fucking, you can ask for the cookie and they have M&Ms.
I'm aware.
The two things they said, they're really trying to do this thing where they fight back. So Biden goes on the same day that Trump goes to the border, Biden goes to the border and Biden says, okay, you want to make immigration this issue, let's go. You know, he's really calling their bluff, right? They have this very, very right-leaning bill that gives them everything they want, can close the border, can do this, can do that. And I mean, the speech that Biden gave was like, you know, they can come to the table anytime they want. I mean, it's annoying on some level because as someone who doesn't necessarily think that a guy who is not the president should be setting the tone, it's annoying, but it's also brilliant. Discuss.
Look, Joe Biden has recognized that you can take the strong argument on immigration, okay, which is we're going to secure the border. We're going to appropriately and humanely manage our border. We're going to toughen up Border Patrol. We're going to give ICE and Border Patrol resources that they need to do their jobs. And that Donald Trump is the one guy who is stopping that. The White House realized that. The Biden campaign realized that. Joe Biden himself realized that. And now they're putting it back on Donald Trump. They're saying, okay, yeah, if this is such a crisis, if the fentanyl is rolling in by the dump truck load and it's an immediate crisis, if the child smugglers are bringing the babies across the border for bad people, then it's an immediate crisis. If there's 1 bajillion, trillion, gazillion immigrants crossing over every day with their strange foreign languages and their delicious ethnic foods, we have to stop it. If that's the case,
languages that no one's ever heard,
languages no one speaks. Yeah, and in Donald Trump's case, one of those languages would be English.
Right.
But this idea that they've inverted the dynamic of power and the strong side of the argument, assertive side of the argument. You know, Biden is now the guy who wants to close the border. He wants to enforce the border. And this popular Fox illusion of Biden open the border for the brown caravans.
Right.
It's all a lie. It is about as truthful as the Hunter Biden evidence, which was to say not truthful at all. And so now Biden's like, okay, Donald, come to the table. Mano a mano. If the dividing line in this race becomes Joe Biden saying we should secure the border and Donald Trump saying we should build concentration camps before we deport them, Joe Biden's going to win on that issue.
And I think that's the calculus. Sean Hannity, perhaps you remember him, said Biden visiting the border is a cynical, sick political stunt and beyond disgraceful. Joe Biden should know that the only people allowed to visit the border for sick political stunts are Republicans. He then, in the same breath, plugs his upcoming show with Trump to be aired from the border.
I will never get over, you know, seeing Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott and Ted Cruz and all these other guys down there wearing their wish.com fake LBV bulletproof vest plate carriers and their wraparound Oakleys, thinking that they're some sort of like cosplay special operator bullshit. All of them go down to the border at the drop of a hat, stare across the Rio Grande and say, "Dear God, the caravan, it sweeps the horizon, and it's all people with not a single blue-eyed soul among them. Oh, my God." The drama that these assholes indulge themselves in about the border, it's only increased because, like heroin addicts, they're chasing the dragon of that first flush of how great it was, you know, when they first started going down there. Now they have to do the barbed wire barricades and the floating razor balls and all that crap in the river. And they've become part of the Fox News production cycle. They've become part of the scare tactics cycle over and over and over again.
We are a country of immigrants, right? I mean, the whole premise of this fucking country mm-hmm. is that we all came here and then killed all the indigenous people because this was the dream of America. So the idea, and again, like the other thing, which I think even Democrats have gotten a little bit removed from, is like immigrants are good for the economy. Like you have a tight labor market. You need these people.
Let me just say this. Not super widely known, but my family is in agriculture, citrus, soy, hogs, peanuts, corn. Florida agriculture right now is in a desperate collapse because you know what? Nobody's here anymore. They can't get workers. They can't get people to come and do the work. And so the idea of, oh, well, of course, these immigrants are taking this backbreaking minimum wage labor away from deserving white men.
People who don't want it. Yeah.
Guess what? You can't get people right now in Florida. You can't get them in California and Arizona. We are killing a giant sector of our economy. The ag sector in particular is suffering. But, you know, this is also why states are like, we've got to get those 13-year-olds working again. My God, the moral failing of this country where the kids can't go down, they yearn for the coal mines.
Right, exactly. But it is, I mean, that is, it's a really good point. And like yesterday I was talking to a guy who works at ProPublica, does very cool private
sure.
partnerships with local news. And he was talking about they have been writing about the farmers in Wisconsin, right? There are a ton of undocumented people working in farms in Wisconsin. And a lot of them don't speak English. What is interesting on the ground is he told me that people who are employing these people know that they need them.
They absolutely understand it. They absolutely know it. And they don't care.
Right.
They don't care. It is an astounding and bitter reality. This is a country that its largest trading partner is south of the border. We have a cross flow of work and workers and products back and forth. And this idea that the border is wide open is, of course, a lie. But we need in this country, for the first time in 45 years, to establish a legitimate, straight up guest worker system where they pay taxes in the system. And the fact that Donald Trump is the one holding the border open right now, all the negative consequences of having a border that is not being enforced right now, the whole fantasy of that they're smuggling hundreds of Al-Qaeda in every day, and you know that 5 million children are trafficked over the border every half hour, and all this other garbage. There are bad things that happen at the border. There are legitimate concerns at the border, but they are not at the scale that you would think that they are on Fox News. And the downsides of the idea of putting an iron wall across the border is that we're going to collapse several sectors of our economy pretty dramatically if we had the fantasy wall of Donald Trump from Baja to Brownsville.
The idea that somehow building an enormous wall with, the fact that we're even talking about this 8 years later, right, is such proof that everything has gotten so stupid, right? There's no world in which an enormous concrete wall in a porous border is going to do anything but enrich the construction companies, which is why it's such a great Trumpy scam, right?
Look, Steve Bannon and his people, they wanted to take it private and build a private wall.
Yes, where you have to pay to look at it. The whole thing is preposterous.
It's absurdity.
But speaking of preposterous, there's one last thing we have to talk about, which is Donald Trump, a master at punting when it comes to his legal challenges discussed.
Well, look, the court, as I call it now, the red court, they gave Donald Trump two great gifts. They gave him time and they gave him this comfort, basically. The time that they gave him to push this thing into July is the clock running on Merrick Garland. And hey, how y'all like Merrick Garland now, by the way? Just
I don't
throw
like
that
him.
Out there. I know. I'm just saying. But Merrick Garland is going to pick up the phone to Jack Smith and say, hey, look, you did a great job. Clock ran out. Way it goes. You got to wrap it up. He's the Republican nominee. And that was the thing they gave Trump is by that point, the convention won't matter. He'll have the delegates. And they're going to do it by acclamation sooner than later. He'll be the Republican nominee. And that is going to buy him a hall pass on this. And the court, for all that people say, oh, John Roberts is an institutionalist and he wants to protect. Yeah, guess what? John Roberts, there are three people on the court who are the products of the MAGA era. Okay, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Comey Barrett. They are, for all Donald Trump makes jokes about it, they are his people. To whatever degree Alito and Thomas represented an earlier time, they are both now obviously locked in on a partisan frame where they don't care. I think Clarence Thomas now is, even though his wife is a part of the case, and he should recuse himself, he's basically an extended middle finger to the country. And Roberts doesn't even have the moral courage to tell Thomas he should recuse. I'm not going to give John Roberts a lot more grace and running room here because this was a decision. Look, I was around for Bush v. Gore and they took it up in 3 days.
Yeah, we're going to not talk about Bush v. Gore. Thank you, Rick Wilson.
Anytime.
Hey, guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you know Rick Wilson and I are bringing together some friends for a general election kickoff party at City Winery in New York on March 6th? We're going to be chatting right after Super Tuesday about what's going on, and it is going to probably be the one fun night for the next 80 days. If you're in the New York area, please come by and join us. You can go to City Winery's website and grab a ticket. And Noah Shachtman is the former editor-in-chief of Rolling Stone. Welcome back, friend, boss, colleague, Noah Shachtman.
Yo. Hi, Bonnie.
Let's talk about drugs.
Great. One of my favorite topics.
You have a huge scoop that has just dropped today. It's Monday, or at least it'll be Monday when you're listening to this, or maybe it will be Tuesday, Wednesday, whatever. It centers on the Trump White House and all the stuff that everyone was taking. So talk us through exactly how this went down.
Sure. So about 6 weeks ago, there was a report by the Defense Department's Inspector General that laid out all these irregularities in the way that they were handing out prescription medications. But it was all kind of vague, and it was all kind of weird. And candidly, White Houses have been for a long time handing out prescription medications on flights to make sure that, you know, Ambien, to make sure people, you know, sleep on an overseas flight or something like that. But what my colleague and I discovered is freaking crazy, which is, and there's a couple of different parts to it. Let's go over the first part first, which is just widespread
abuse of a very powerful stimulant called Provigil, or Modafinil is the generic name. It's a drug that the military's pilots use to keep awake when they're on like long missions. But in the Trump White House, it was being passed around like old school speed. And in fact, when we talked to Trump White House staffers, they talked about a White House that was, quote, awash in speed. And if you're ever taken to speed before, or any of these uppers, they do not exactly produce clear thinking over the long haul. They do not exactly produce rational thought in the long term, even if they're good at keeping you awake in the short term. So that's the first of several things we found.
We don't know who was taking it, though, right? It could be anyone in that White House. It wasn't clear who.
Well, put it to you this way. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of pills ordered over a very short time, like a few months. So it not only literally could have been anybody, it might have literally been everybody, if you know what I mean.
I mean, how does this compare to normal White Houses?
There's really no comparison. So let's just say that my colleagues, Swin Soup-Sang, and I talked to like everybody involved, including people that were involved in other White Houses. And while they would occasionally hand out this drug if, you know, there was like an overnight flight and someone had trouble sleeping and needed to be up for a meeting with a world leader the next day, they never ever used it like the Trump White House did, which was, you know, speechwriters would use it to jam out speeches. Comms people would use it to spin the media. Lawyers, or I'm not sure about lawyers, but people responding to Robert Mueller's probe would use it to, you know, try to insist, come up with new rationales for why they totally weren't in bed with Russia. Like, it was really a pretty widespread usage.
Is this all Ronnie Jackson? I mean, where does this originate?
Right. So Ronnie Jackson, who was the head of the White House medical unit and physician to the president under both Obama and Trump, this all seems to circle back on him. Now, Ronnie Jackson is...
He's now a member of Congress, which is the most amazing part of this whole story.
Yeah, which is wild. He was not the planet's most respected doctor. So, for example, the Pentagon did a different report about his behavior when he was Obama's doctor. And he had seemed to have a habit of getting wasted and banging on female subordinates' hotel room doors. No, they couldn't verify whether he had gotten wasted and crashed a car, although there was that allegation. And this is my favorite part, is that they interviewed 60 of his current and former subordinates, and 56 saw him being abusive or had him being abusive to them. So he's not the best. And so a lot of these problems were traced back to him. That said, Jackson was out of the Trump White House by 2019. And even though his subordinates, his minions, were kind of running the shop, these problems persisted in the Trump White House right till the very end.
Right. So when he left, there was another doctor who came from the same school of Dr. Feelgood Medicine?
Well, I would say that Jackson had both installed his minions in key spots throughout the administration on the medical side, and that the culture that he had promoted, what one source told us was a kind of Wild West in which anyone, quote, got anything they wanted, that culture took a long time to unwind and really took at least through the Trump administration, through the end of it.
What else is sort of shocking?
The modafinil, the military grade speed, was only the beginning of it. Like I said, there was a culture of anything, anytime, anywhere, any drug you need. And one of the drugs that people seemed to need the most was Xanax, which is an anti-anxiety medication. Why is it? And it's also a very powerful sedative.
You don't need, I'm a Jewish woman. You don't need to tell me what Xanax is. Now, that said, I have been sober since I was 19. But, you know, you explaining Xanax to me, like, okay, it's what you take to come down from cocaine. Anyway, continue.
That's like explaining like pastrami on rye.
Yeah, yeah.
So not only was the Trump White House an incredibly stressful place to work, but if you're already hopped up on uppers, you need something to be able to sleep in a couple hours through the night. And so there was a pretty widespread culture of Xanax usage too. Now that's important for a bunch of different reasons, including A, Xanax was never mentioned in that initial Pentagon report I mentioned. That was one of the things. So that was not written down in these ledgers that they obtained of all these various drugs that were prescribed at the Trump White House. That's something else. And then the other thing is that they were not only taking Xanax, but many of them were taking Xanax and drinking too. Now, one Xanax by itself can mellow you out. you started taking Xanax and having a couple of drinks with it, and it can be really serious. And you know, you do too much of that and it can have huge risks to your health. So doing sort of uppers and Xanax with booze, that is a really scary roller coaster to ride.
Do you think that this will have repercussions to Dr. Jackson?
I don't know. Honestly, I've been surprised he hasn't suffered more repercussions already. I'm surprised he got into Congress. So I'm not sure what the consequences will be for Dr. Jackson. I think the consequences for the country, if this kind of drugstore cowboy rodeo returns to the White House, I think are really serious. I mean, we already know.
He'll be visiting us in Portugal. So, I mean, yes, continue.
But I mean, I feel like, look, we already know these guys have some really kooky plans in place. So if you layer on top of that kooky plans and even, you know, kookier decision-making, more erratic, more hopped up, that seems like a really bad combination.
It does. And we've seen lots of authoritarian regimes that were powered by speed.
Yeah, it's true. And then, you know, the other thing, speaking of authoritarian regimes, is like, you know, there's a real climate in the Trump White House of fear and paranoia, you know, and it was sometimes the benefits of reporters like us where, you know, people would be more inclined to snitch on their you know, bureaucratic rivals than they were to actually do their jobs. And people were, you know, constantly scared and constantly trying to jockey for position to get in Trump's favor. And it created this atmosphere, especially with Roddy Jackson, of fear and paranoia. And we uncovered something new that really added to that climate of fear and paranoia, which is I tracked down a mental health worker who was doing therapy sessions for administration officials in the Trump White House. And what this source told me was that they were marched to a particular, you know, official's office. The therapy session would happen. And then immediately afterwards, the therapist was grilled about what the Trump official said in therapy.
Oh, amazing.
Which is wild.
That's not how any of this is supposed to work, but...
No, it's really not.
Wow.
Yeah, and so breaching that kind of therapist confidentiality, you know, it was particularly shocking to me. I'm married to a psychiatrist, and obviously as a New York Jew...
Therapy is something near and dear to your heart.
But, I mean, I think that's shocking to pretty much everyone. The one of the senior people at the White House Medical Unit, a professional named Keith Bass, who's now at the VA and who served many presidents, he claimed that this was all just to make sure that people that were military members were still fit for duty and still fit for top secret clearance. That was his claim and told it to us on the record. So he admitted that the therapist was grilled after sessions. However, then I went back to the therapist and was like, what's up with this? And the therapist said, no, that's not right. First of all, you know, I saw both military and civilians. So that military only thing is wrong. And number two, the therapist really felt like while the question started out broad, they really went down a slippery slope and really just contributed to an anything goes atmosphere where could hand out any drug and say anything about any patient behind their back, and that information was really handled loosely.
Yeah, I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know. It's one of these things, like, to me, it like, honestly, it helped make a little bit more sense of that madhouse because people were literally on drugs and spying on each other.
Yeah, who could have seen it? It's basically everything you'd think. It strikes me that it seems like there hasn't been a ton of accountability for any of this.
No, there hasn't been.
Call me a Pollyanna, but like, isn't there a world where people get in trouble for doing bad illegal stuff or now?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think I'm a little surprised there hasn't been also like just medical repercussions for people, like a little surprised the people involved in this haven't suffered any repercussions, you know, just within their licensing bureaus or whatever. That sounds like small potatoes prefer a doctor. It's really not. So no, there haven't been any repercussions yet, but I think what we've been able to do is really show like a little bit more why things happen the way they happen at the Trump White House and what might happen in the future. Molly, I just want to say the other thing, like, you know, this is a story for Rolling Stone, right? Rolling Stone is an anti-drug, you know, outfit or anything like that.
Yes. Yes, I'm aware.
So I'm not trying to be all
sober.
Yeah, I'm hardly that, as you know. But like, I think there's a big difference between having some fun or expanding your mind in the way you choose and abusing prescription meds at the highest levels of government. Those feel like two different things. And so, you know, I'm not trying to be all pearl clutching here.
But this is bad.
Yeah, this ain't great. And honestly, I was shocked with what I found. Really shocked.
Noah Shankman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Molly.
Michael Leeroff and Peter Shamshiri are the hosts of the podcast 5 to 4. My favorite podcast is this podcast called 5 to 4 about how the Supreme Court sucks. And I'm a huge fan. And yesterday, when the Supreme Court did yet another incredibly fucked up thing, I thought, I wonder if I could email Leon and ask him if we could get two of the hosts of 5 to 4. So we did, and they're here. Help me welcome Michael.
Hi, everybody. Very pleased to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you, and Peter.
Hello.
And very excited to have you both. Two of the three hosts. Rihanna's not here. Someone talk us through what the fuck happened yesterday.
I can walk you through the basics, I guess. Donald Trump is obviously, he's been indicted in a few different states by a few different actors, but one of them, the special counsel, Jack Smith, has indicted him in federal court in the District of Columbia for crimes related to the January 6th riot, including conspiracy against rights and conspiracy to defraud the United States. President Trump has raised a defense saying he is immune from criminal prosecution for his actions around and leading up to January 6th. And yesterday, the Supreme Court agreed to hear that argument and scheduled oral argument for late April, which had the effect of delaying the ability to try Donald Trump on these charges and take that trial to completion before the election. That seems impossible now.
And if I can add some color here, the D.C. Circuit had basically ruled against Trump earlier this month. So the Supreme Court had a couple of options. They could have just allowed that to stand and said, you're not immune. The trial's going forward. Or they could have taken up the case in some form or fashion, which is what they did. What they did that was so bizarre, I think a lot of people expected that they might take up the case, but what they did that was so bizarre was take it up on such a kind of slow schedule. Usually they'd take something like this up on an expedited basis so that we're getting it dealt with in the span of a few weeks rather than a few months.
Like Bush versus Gore.
Right. Or like they've sped along some other Trump proceedings, like the 14th Amendment claim, which they dealt with relatively quickly. And I think, you know, we'll probably see an opinion a little bit faster in that case. So they expedite things all the time. It's not uncommon. And it's pretty telling that they didn't do it here.
Yeah. And to make that point even stronger, back in December, when Donald Trump indicated he was going to appeal on the basis of this immunity, the special counsel brought this to the Supreme Court and said, let's skip the D.C. Circuit. This is a big, important issue. It's going to end up here anyway. So why don't you just take this up? And the court could have done that in December. They did that. They've skipped, you know, circuit review in, for example, the student loan case where they nullified Biden's student debt relief. They skipped the Circuit Court of Appeals there. This is something they could do. They've done recently. Instead, they kicked it down to the D.C. Circuit and wasted 3 months and then took it up. Just wasting everybody's time, clearly just delaying this to put any possible resolution past the elections. The only possible explanation here, the only plausible explanation.
They granted cert, right? Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, cert is just the court accepting a case. You need four justices to grant cert as opposed to five for, you know, an actual majority. They're just saying, yeah, we're going to hear this case on the merits. I think, again, that was something people expected. People just didn't expect them to put it on a slow-moving schedule.
Right. If you were trying to help out Donald Trump, this would be the way you would do it.
Absolutely. Trump's main tactic, his main litigation strategy, and all these cases has been delay, with the hopes that he can win the 2024 election and then, you know, use his power as president to shut down the investigations or prosecutions on the federal level and shield himself from having to pay any judgments or serve any prison time at the state level. That's what he's trying to do. And the court is helping him. They are just straight up enabling him.
So I think of it as like there are three Trump installed justices, right? The smartest of whom is Amy Coney Barrett by a large margin, but she's still a zealot.
Yes. Yes.
And then you have like the Fox News brain damaged Alito and Thomas. And then you have like the sort of Roberts who is still like pretending that he's normal, but he's not. When you look at this case, almost everyone thought that this would absolutely not be called up. And I'm hoping you could talk about this week on your excellent podcast. You guys talked about the Nixon case, which is really preposterous. Will you talk about that and how that plays into all of this?
Yeah, sure. So Nixon v. Fitzgerald is really the only Supreme Court case that has dealt with immunity for presidents. It was from 1982. It was, by Nixon standards, relatively small potatoes. It's just a guy who testified. He was in the Air Force, and then Nixon fired him once Nixon got into office on the basis that he didn't like his testimony. And the guy sued for basically wrongful termination, and the Supreme Court said, well, we're not going to allow civil damages against presidents for things they do in office, for like official acts they take in office. There is really no case that deals with criminal immunity. So the Nixon case is sort of all we have. And frankly, it's just not really on point. You know, I think everyone agrees that, you know, hiring and firing within the military or executive agencies is something that is a part of the president's job to some degree. Whether facilitating a coup is part of the president's job is a whole different question.
Right.
So we're in a totally different scenario here. And, you know, we're sort of just staring at the Nixon case thinking, well, is there anything it can tell us about the Trump situation? Frankly, I'm not sure that there's too much.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's hard to say what precisely tack the Supreme Court's going to take here. But it does seem like they might be setting this up to say, well, does the Nixon v. Fitzgerald case extend to criminal liability as well? And to say, no, that does not mean you're immune from criminal liability.
They have no leg to stand on here, though.
No, yeah, it's a crazy and frankly frivolous argument. The Constitution explicitly contemplates the president being subject to criminal process after leaving the office. In the impeachment judgment clause, it says, after you're impeached, you know, that doesn't stop you from being prosecuted for crimes that you committed while in office. So it's right there in the text of the Constitution. It's a pretty wild claim, but it's not one I think Trump expected to win on, just to drag this out long enough. His lackeys on the court have obliged him in that.
Everyone, I mean, I actually was talking on the phone, or I was talking in person to, was one of those like very smart people who were like, oh, they're never going to take this up. And I feel like this Supreme Court does tend to plumb the depths.
Yeah. You know, you'll never go broke betting that they will just do whatever, like the worst Fox News brained, like, you know, 4chan or Reddit commenter wants them to do. It's pretty wild. This is very, very hackish and in the tank for Trump in a way that is like even a little surprising to me, to be honest. And we are pretty cynical about this court.
Peter, are you surprised?
I don't think I'm as surprised as a lot of other people. I do think that, you know, if you look at a lot of commentators from a few days ago, they were saying, well, the worst case scenario is that the court will take up the case and drag this through late March. And what they actually did was drag it through late April at the earliest. So I do think it was a situation where just about everyone was caught off guard by the scale of what they did, whether you predicted some little part of it or not. So I don't want to pretend that I was the one person to see this coming. I really didn't see all of it coming. But it doesn't surprise me that four or five justices on the court would want to deal with the immunity issue themselves rather than have the D.C. circuit be the last word.
But do you think, again, Jesse always says, like, bad podcasting is trying to predict the future, but it's so crazy. I mean, you think they're going to be like, you can be immune from all the crimes you did?
No, I think that, you know, Trump's bringing a few different arguments. The craziest one is basically, you know, the court lacks jurisdiction to review any of this due to separation of powers, which would basically mean that the president is a god king and can commit all sorts of heinous crimes as long as there's just
SEAL Team 6, right?
Right. This is the theory that, like, you know, you can just kill your political opponent, and when Congress tries to impeach you, you kill them too. And this is all somehow technically legal, right? I don't think the court buys that, but there are some slightly subtler arguments that he is making. One is that they can just say, well, look, he's immune for certain types of actions, and this is one of those actions, that we are going to say that this is an official act, which is the term that the court in Nixon v. Fitzgerald used. Now, is that a good argument? No, but it is sort of a limiting principle that might prevent the worst case sort of scenarios. The other thing they can do is basically say that impeachment is the proper process to go through here, and that you sort of need to move your way through the entire impeachment and conviction process for any criminal proceeding to then come thereafter. That's an argument that Trump has made. He's also made the complete reverse argument before when he was getting impeached. He said, no, you have to criminally prosecute me first. But he's making some arguments that are maybe just a little, I don't think they're better arguments, but they are a little more tolerable to the median person in the United States. So the court might bounce some of those around.
Yeah, I think ultimately it seems like a very John Roberts sort of move to say, you know, within a couple weeks of each other or a couple months of each other, Donald Trump has to be on the ballot. You can't use the 14th Amendment insurrection ban to bar him from the ballot, but he also has to stand trial for any crimes he may have committed while in office. A real classic Roberts split the baby type thing. And, oh, hopefully you don't notice why we were coming to this decision, this magnanimous decision. We delayed the trial well past when it would have any political impact. That all feels very like his style. They did something similar with this case, Trump v. Mazars, which was about subpoenaing the president, and they delayed that. They ultimately resolved it, and Trump lost, but after it had any force or meaning because he had left office. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if that's the direction they go here. I think 6-7 years ago, the political media might have been taken in by that approach. They don't seem as easily fooled by it. You know, the New York Times had an editorial last night saying this was a huge win for Trump, and their front page this morning framed this as a victory for Trump. I think people are sort of wise to this little game that Roberts likes to play at this point, and the court has lost any benefit of the doubt it used to get. And I think that's a good thing. I think they should feel political repercussions for this. You know, if the Democratic Party wants to impose them, I think it would be well received by the public.
I have a question about this, which is this court, when they overturned Roe, they sort of made a decision with, you know, politics be damned. What's the political calculus of taking this case?
Yeah, if you're looking at the big picture political calculus, it's probably bad for the institution of the court. But there are some pretty strong indicators that the justices don't really care about that and have basically made the decision that whatever happens to the institution of the court, the Democrats don't have the political juice to pack the court. They don't have the political juice to impeach Clarence Thomas or anything along those lines. So will people get mad? Sure. But that's sort of the cost of doing business. And meanwhile, you know, they're getting high fives at the Federalist Society meetings. So from their perspective, you know, who cares? Maybe you get some bad op-eds in the New York Times, but cost of doing business, that's the price you pay, in their view, for being a fearless truth teller who is defending Donald Trump, right? I think that's the Sam Alito calculus, frankly. I do think it's somewhat detached from reality, but there's also a pragmatism to it. I think it's true that the Democratic Party doesn't really have the muscle right now to hold the court accountable. And I think the court's aware of that.
Yeah, I think they learned a lesson from Dobbs, the case overturning Roe v. Wade, and not the one we would have wanted. Obviously, the Republican Party underperformed historically compared to expectations in the midterm elections that followed. But Joe Biden, the president, was very against any efforts to push back and, you know, reform the court in the wake of Dobbs. He didn't really want to take them on at the time. And what did the Supreme Court care that the Republicans took a loss, right? They're still in power. They're still able to overturn the student debt relief, for example, or end affirmative action, or any of the other number of horrible things they've done or will do. You know, they're saying, we'll hold all the cards, and you guys aren't even willing to talk about doing anything to take them from our hands. So why would we slow down? I think it's ultimately until an institutional counter emerges to them from either Congress or the executive that is willing to actually push back on them, they are going to feel completely uninhibited. And that's frightening. That's frightening to me.
Thank you guys for coming on the show and making me more depressed. But also, it's such an interesting problem because it really is. Democrats have to get going on it.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I think their voters will be with you. Nobody's very happy with the court right now. So you just got to do it. You got to bite the bullet.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Rick Wilson, do you want me to go first or do you want to go first?
You go first. You roll your moment of fuckery.
Okay, so my moment of fuckery is like, we've been talking a lot about like Republicans making absolutely moronic political decisions that will later cause them to lose everything. Continuing that theme, my moment of fuckery is Cindy Hyde-Smith, who you may know her as
Meemaw.
Meemaw, yes, as Meemaw. She's a United States senator, or at least they've sort of propped her. By the way, Alabama, they have found every white woman who is like about 80 who may or may not be totally with it and prop them up, right? They're like, we have women here. Cindy Hyde-Smith, she's from Mississippi. She once dressed up as a Confederate soldier because who among us, Tammy Duckworth, tried to codify IVF. We're not even talking about abortion. Right. We're not even talking about like, you know, same-sex marriage. We're talking about IVF. It's something that probably more Republicans, because richer people tend to do IVF, but so probably more Republicans than Democrats, who even knows, but a lot of people use IVF. Is not a controversial way to conceive a child.
No.
We are now, Republicans refused, Cindy Hyde-Smith refused to do a vote to codify IVF. So the Republicans have now explained to us that they do not give a fuck.
If I had gone first, I would have given you the exact same moment of fuckery. I want to actually encourage the Republicans to do something. Be true to yourselves. Go out and say it. Say you don't want anybody to get IVF. Because after Hyde-Smith did it, not one of them was out there saying, my God, my colleague on my side of the aisle is wrong. You know what they did? They all shut up and they all hid. And guys, if you're going to do this, if Republicans are going to go this way and go up against a process that is costly, painful, desperate, of families who are hurting, desperate to have a child. If you guys want to go that way, have at it. Enjoy.
Can I just ask you a question about this? Because you actually know about the dark arts here. I just remember from when I got IVF, because we had these two children made in a lab in New Jersey, because we carried a Jewish genetic disease. When I was there, I was like, this doctor's office is so fucking fancy. They have fancy magazines. They have fancy coffee. They have fancy, fancy, fancy. And I thought to myself, these doctors make a ton of money. So let me just ask you, we don't have tort reform, right? We don't have tort reform because of that. Isn't this an enormous lobbying group? I mean, aren't these doctors going to just lobby the hell out of Congress?
It won't take the doctors to do it, Molly. It'll be the families. It'll be the people who, I mean, look, I had a long talk with a friend who has also done IVF the other day. And this is somebody who's not incredibly political. And she's like, I am furious. And she said two kids through IVF. And it was painful and costly and hard. And these are not people who are super wealthy either. And they had to, like, you know, second mortgage on their house to do this thing. And they were desperate for children. And it's like, do they know how many of us there are? And they clearly don't. They clearly don't. I think it's really an interesting moment right now of just how broken-brained the Republican Party is to think that this is a winning issue for them. I mean, look, they sent out a poll memo last week to their members saying, don't do this, don't say this. But that didn't stop Meemaw and the rest of these weirdos from leaping into the deep end of the pool.
It is amazing, though. And that is a really good point. I also think, like, the other thing we're going to see, and we're seeing it in Oklahoma already, is they're coming after IUDs.
Why do you need an IUD, Molly? You're some kind of tramp?
That's basically
the fucking message, you know?
I feel like this is like, it reminds me of Tipper Gore coming after pornography. It's like, this is such right. a loser, and I look forward to you losing on it.
I really want them. If they want to go all the way, go all the way. You know, and then again, we've joked about or talked about, eventually, you know, it's like, oh, you can't divorce your husband while you're pregnant, little lady. You're not thinking clearly. Why do you need a checkbook, honey? The whole thing inevitably grinds down to this roaring, insane hatred of women. That's my moment of fuckery, and we shared a moment of fuckery. We'll see you all this week on Wednesday in New York City at the City Winery, if you can still get a ticket, which you probably can't.
About 10 left.
10 left. Get on it.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Kurt Woodsmith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
Like our recent episode with Melissa Joan Hart.
LL Cool J gave me some great advice. He had all these gold chains and I was like, wow, look at all these diamonds. And he said something to the effect of, don't waste your money on something like this, buy a house. Like he gave me like solid investment advice where I was like, save my money, got it.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.